Good morning.
Morning.
I'm somebody else, as I always say. From over there, I'm one person. Here, I'm somebody else. So I have to say good morning. Or more Hebrew for you. Boker Tov, gentlemen. Good morning. Good to have you with us. So, the Great Commission. How about another message? Who wants to hear a message, another one, on the Great Commission? Well, I would, but I'm going to teach you something else. It's called the Great Omission. Are you familiar with the Great Omission? Ever heard of it? I wouldn't expect you to. And not that the Great Commission is not worthy of a very, very robust teaching and memory, and we're going to talk about it a little bit. But the Great Omission and the Great Commission are pretty closely related. And the fact that you don't know about it is hopefully one of the reasons that you're here today. Because you wouldn't know about it. But I want to forewarn you that today's subject matter is a little bit on the heavy side, and maybe not all that easy to listen to, but it's very, very, very important, because this is your faith, this is your belief in God, this is the foundation, your messianic hope, your future, the foundation of what the Bible says. It all sort of hinges on being able to understand what the Bible says. And so, we need to talk about a divorce that took place thousands of years ago. But before we do that, since there are new people with us today, what are my qualifications to do this? Why do I get to teach you this? Why do I get to talk about it? Well, because I'm a Messianic Jew, for starters, okay? What's that mean? Well, we have some people here who want to know what that means. So the full picture of that will be laid out sort of over the next 4 weeks in this series. I hope you'll come back to hear it. But what is a Messianic Jew? A Jew who believes in the Messiah. Messianic Jew. There's a problem with that, though. Most Jews believe in the Messiah and pray every single day, three times a day, for the return of the Messiah to come. So you could say almost all religious Jews are Messianic Jews, except there's a particular connotation with our kind of Messianic Judaism, and that is that we already know who the Messiah is. We claim that Yeshua is Lord. He is the Messiah. And so we believe that he's come, and we believe that he's returning again. So Judaism, traditional Judaism, if we called them Messianic Jews, they are, with a first-time hope that Messiah is going to come and restore the kingdom and deliver Israel and do all the things that Israel was hoping he was going to do the first time. But our particular Messianic Judaism centers on, as you heard in much of the liturgy, Yeshua, Jesus. Okay? Who is a Messianic Jew? Well, I am. He is. She is. He is. She is. There's several around you. And thankfully, also, there's a whole lot of Messianic Gentiles. There are people from the Israel and the nations gather here in the sanctuary to lift up and exalt the name of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the name of Yeshua. But here are some more famous Messianic Jews that you might know. Peter, Paul, John, James, Simon. There were a lot of them, and they were all there was in the beginning, not like the Bereshit in the beginning, Genesis. The beginning when Yeshua brought his message of salvation. Why then Messianic Judaism? Why? Why still? Why is it here? Well, because Yeshua gave us a task. He gave it to us, to those very famous disciples that I just mentioned who were the first Messianic Jews. Remember what he said to them? He gave them, here's your message on the Great Commission. He gave them this message and said, oh, I forgot. I have slides. Thank you. One second here. He gave them the Great Commission, and he said to them, go and make disciples of all the nations, teaching them all that I have taught you, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, right? That's the Great Commission. Now, how have we done on that? Well, there's been a lot of baptizing. There's been a lot of believers. But the teaching them all that I have taught you part, how's that gone? Well, you wouldn't be able to answer that. And here's why. Because of this. The great omission. What Jesus actually believed, said, and taught and passed down to his disciples, unfortunately, has been sort of changed. It's been masked. It's been covered. It's been canceled. It's been omitted. That didn't start with him. It didn't start with the disciples. It didn't start with the earliest Gentiles the Gentile followers of Jesus. It came much, much later. Well, no, it didn't. It didn't come much later. I'm going to show you how quickly it started. The great omission, the separation, the changing, the canceling. C.S. Lewis wrote a book called The Great Divorce. This is actually the great divorce that we're going to talk about. People don't always like to hear this, but Judaism is the foundation of what is known as Christianity. It is. And, you know, we actually, in promoting the Jewish Jesus series that we're launching this week, we ran some promo ads on a not-to-be-named social media site. My heavens, the comments. We had a very wide audience. The comments that came in there. Hatred and ignorance and just absolute amazing wow. Couldn't believe it. But that's all part of this. And it confirmed for me and for us why we exist to teach things like this. Judaism is the foundation of Christianity. Some very, very influential thinkers also believe that. Swiss Reformed theologian Karl Barth, if you remember him, the church must live with the synagogue, not as fools say in their hearts, as with another religion or confession, but as with the root from which it sprung. This is a Swiss Reformed theologian. It passed on down to Catholic priests, Richard John Neuhaus. It is misleading, I believe, to speak of two peoples of God or two covenants, never mind to speak of two religions. So approximately 1900 years ago, a separation occurred, one that would have been unimaginable to the followers of this guy right here. Because, see him? See how handsome he is? No, there he is. That is the Jewish Jesus. Yeshua, I've already taught you his name that his mother would have called him. The Jewish Messiah, Yehoshua, a rough and ruddy Galilean woodworking guy. With rough hands, he had olive skin, he had dark hair, Middle Eastern features. He was a follower of the Torah, the law of Moses. He ate biblically according to what the laws of God instructed. He celebrated the festivals. He didn't have exactly what is called a bar mitzvah, by the way we know it in 2021. But as he came of age, he had a celebration, right? A becoming a son of the commandment. But then emerging from the early church became this guy. This is blonde-haired, blue-eyed Jesus. Have you met him? This is a different guy. This is the guy who actually nailed the law of Moses to the cross. He denied all aspects of his Judaism. As a matter of fact, he didn't even like Jews. He called them sons of Satan and cursed them. And he became not the Messiah of Israel, but he became the Messiah of the church. Because why? Because the church replaced Israel in his world and in the world of the people who created him. Because that's what he came to do, right? He came to fix broken down Judaism. Now, these are sort of controversial, and yes, I'm a little in your face because that's just the way it is with this stuff. But the material will be challenging if someone is not willing to entertain the history of this. This is much less theological. It's a lot less theology lesson than history lesson. And history can't be denied, though people try to deny that it did take place. And I'm talking about one thing in particular, which you're probably pretty well aware of, that many, and the growing tide of people who suggest that 13 million, 6 million of whom were Jews, a million of whom were Jewish children, that never happened. But that's another message. So this can be very challenging. If you're not willing to accept or review the history, it can also be very enlightening in terms of the way that you see your Bible and understand how we got from there to here, if you'll go along with me. And most people are not willing to go along with me. So I'm glad you're here. We'll see at the end. I'm kidding. I love everybody. But here is, this is very quickly what we will consider in our 4 weeks of lessons. This week we talk about this. We talk about the divorce today. Next we're going to talk about Yeshua and his Jewish identity. And the third week we'll talk about his continuing practice of Judaism with some particularly controversial things like celebrating holidays and not eating bacon. Fourth, the message of Jesus, the most important thing, right? The gospel of Jesus. Believe in me, when you die, you'll go to heaven. Is that really what the gospel message of Jesus is? That's week four. Like I said, I hope you'll come back. But here's a thing. How did we get here? Well, as I've said already, the first century, the first half, at least all of Yeshua's life and slightly after, this was a strictly and completely Jewish movement. Did you know that? Did you know that? It was. And here's a little bit of a confirmation. This is from the book of Acts, chapter 2. Maybe you guys can just advance my slides because this thing doesn't want to work very well. This is from Acts 2. They were continually devoting themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread, and to the prayer. To prayer. Now, this is people in the temple in Acts 2, all the followers of Jesus. That word prayer, some other prayers have it. You can go back to where we were. Help me out on those slides if you can. Those prayers, it is translated in many translations, but it's not devoting themselves to the prayer, it says. Do you know what the prayer was? It was what I taught you over there called the Amidah, the prayer. They gathered together in the temple, bringing sacrifices. Even after Jesus, they did that. And they devoted themselves to the prayer. And it became, though, very, very important. You know, the temple was destroyed in 70. It became very, very important at that point for Judaism to kind of close ranks around what was going to be the new Judaism. With no temple, that put a real hindrance in Jewish practice. So the rabbis, with God's help, created what we now know sort of as rabbinic Judaism. But even heretics within Judaism, Sadducees and these new Jewish believers in Jesus, even though they were sort of heretics and had moved away from some of the rabbinic Judaism, they were still Jews in the minds of Judaism. So, I want to make this one very important point. A divorce is never... Well, very rarely, I should say. A divorce is very rarely one-sided. We're going to talk a lot about the church today, the early church, but it's also important to realize that Judaism was not a friend to the new believers in Jesus either. And so we each had a part to play. Judaism kind of pushed out those followers of Jesus. That created a bit of a problem. But still, when Jesus is talking about you sons of Satan and all these other kinds of things, that's like me saying to my brother, hey, you dum-dum head. It's a family thing. I wouldn't go up to Sam and say, hey, you stupid. But that's what some of the words, that, now Faye, I don't know, but they... There was this in-house thing going on within Judaism. And then what happened? The Gentiles showed up. And what was it supposed to look like? What was it supposed to look like? It was supposed to look like this in Acts 15. We have the Jerusalem Council. There's a meeting of Jews that are, James was one of them, the leader of the Jerusalem church. It's the Jerusalem body, right? And all the assembly fell silent. Why? Because Paul and Barnabas had showed up and said, guys, you're not going to believe what's happening out there. We've been out there. Gentiles are becoming followers of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob through the message of salvation in Jesus. And nobody really wanted to believe it, but Peter confirmed it. And so that's what James is saying here. Simeon has related how God first visited the Gentiles to take from them a people for his name. So the original question of what to do with the Gentiles coming into this very Jewish movement was answered here. We're not going to do a lot. We're not going to put a lot on them. We're not going to make them become Jews. We're not going to do any of those things. There were a few little things that happened about how Gentiles could come in through Yeshua and participate. And we find it here. It says, and I want you to pay very close attention to this. My judgment is that we should not trouble those of the Gentiles who turn to God. That means don't put a lot on them. They're new. They're babies in the faith. But we should write to them to abstain from things polluted by idols, from sexual immorality, from what has been strangled, and from blood. A lot of those things, interesting, have to do with stuff that's sacrificed to idols. It also has to do with things that you eat. So Gentiles and Jews couldn't hang out together if they were bringing in meat they'd sacrifice to Mars down the road. So these are some basic things, but it's what comes next that I really want you to pay attention to. For from ancient generations, Moses has had in every city those who proclaim him, for he has read every Sabbath in the synagogue. Now listen, this is so very important. You don't need to become Jews, Gentiles. You need to do these things, but all the rest of it, you're going to learn when you come and worship with us every Saturday, every Shabbat in the synagogue. That's what it says. The Gentiles, well, that's, yeah. From ancient generations, Moses has had in every city those who proclaim him, for he's read every Sabbath in the synagogue. That's what James is saying. This is my decree. They're going to learn what they need to know hanging out with us in the synagogue. That's the way it was going to work. Jews and Gentiles, one in Messiah Yeshua, learning and growing in the ways of God, where? In the synagogue. That didn't work very well for traditional Judaism. They didn't like that very much. And Paul, and even within the movement of Jewish believers, sometimes they didn't like Gentiles who had not gone through a full conversion coming into the sanctuary or to the synagogue. And that's why so many of Paul's letters read the way they do. He was battling against that idea that was laid out in Acts 15 that said, you don't have to convert. You can be a full-on participant. And that was a prophetic realization that they had. And it's on that slide where we see that we have Amos. Okay, it's messed up. Forget the slides. I don't care about them. But we got to get eventually to those dates because that's going to be important. Here we go. Bottom line. Miraculously, God had made a way where the nations and Israel were coming together, and that way was in Messiah Yeshua. They were going to be partakers of the promises of Israel. That's Paul's language in Ephesians 2. Through the faith in Messiah, as we read in Acts, and this here it is, after this I will return, I'll rebuild the tent of David that has fallen. Listen, and all the Gentiles who are called by my name, says the Lord, who makes these things known, they're going to come and be a part of this. And that was incredible. But faith in Jesus was a Jewish idea. It was a Jewish thing. It was Jewish. Did I say that? And what happened next? What happened next could have never, ever been comprehended by Peter, Paul, or Mary. No one under 50 even knows what in the world that means. And certainly not by Peter, Paul, Mary, or Yeshua, who never could have imagined this. Because what came next, by 150 CE or AD, if you want to use that terminology, the Jewish movement, this 100% Jewish movement, had become predominantly a Gentile-directed being, and something tragic began to happen. And it really, unfortunately, still does happen today. All right, you ready? Here's my disclaimer. There is never a time once when I stand up here and talk that I ever intend to castigate, speak down, criticize, or complain about what the church is, who's in it, what they've done, what the church continues to accomplish, the miracles upon miracles. We have missionaries from the church who suffered and were abused in prisons for the word of the Lord in this room. From the church. So what I'm about to tell you, which may be a little hard to hear, is not intended to tear down the church. But as I said in the beginning, this is more history than it is theology. And it's very important that you know this for us to be able to go forward for the next 3 weeks. Replacement theology. Who knows that term? Replacement theology is this. As they work on the slides, I'm just going to read this to you. It has a theological name. It's called supersessionism. That's nice, isn't it? Replacement theology works a lot better. It is the idea that Christians have replaced Jews as God's people. What's that look like? This. The New Testament replaces the Old Testament. The church replaces Israel. Christians replace Jews. The Lord's Day replaces the Sabbath. The Lord's Supper, the Eucharist, replaces Passover. And many, 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 many more things that fall under the umbrella of replacement theology. And here is the best way to describe it. Because we have in our culture today a horrendously annoying, horrible thing that's called cancel culture. That's what replacement theology is. If you don't like them, if you don't like what they look like, what they sound like, what they say, cancel them. Write them out of the story. Well, that would never happen. Well, here it is. And it is incredibly and insidiously prevalent. This is how it came to be. Do we have it? Get me to Justin Martyr, and I'm going to blow through these. And you don't actually, I want you to understand that these are some of the pillars. These are the foundations of the early church from the end of the first century and going forward. So here we go, quickly. You ready? No, one more. I think, anyway. Here we go. 150, Justin Martyr. I don't want to read all these, but you can read them with me. For the circumcision, according to the flesh, which is from Abraham, was given a sign that you may be separated from other nations and from us, and that you alone may suffer that which you now justly suffer. 165 AD, Melito of Sardis. The people of Israel was precious before the church arose, but when the church arose, the model was made void. The people were made void. Hippolytus, now then, incline your ear to me and hear my words. Give heed, you Jew. You have been darkened in the eyes of your soul with darkness utter and everlasting. Anyone know who Origen is? Origen is an absolute pillar of the faith. We may thus say with utter confidence that the Jews will not return to their earlier situation. The Jewish nation was driven from its country and other people and another people. The church was called by God to be the blessed election, canceled. Now we move into the church councils. This is the Synod of Elvira. In canon number 50, it was forbidden for Christians to eat with Jews. Remember the thing I said in Acts about we got to set down a few rules so that we can get together and eat, so you're not bringing in the Mars meat. Now it goes the other way, and the pendulum swings. Christians cannot eat with Jews, forbidden. Constantine, he's the pillar. He's where it all started. Constantine was a Roman emperor, a horrendously pagan man, who then became, because he saw a shield in the sky with a cross and said, "In this sign you're going to conquer," Constantine became the first Catholic. He became the first Pope. He became all of these things because he made Christianity the religion of Rome. Here's some of his works. Jews, forbidden to live in Jerusalem, forbidden to try to dissuade anyone who left Judaism. If they were caught, they were burned alive. The Council of Nicaea, I believe in God the Father, almighty maker of heaven, maker of earth. It's a good third day song. Here's some of the things from the Council of Nicaea. We desire, dearest brethren, to separate ourselves from the detestable company of the Jews. 341, Christians, don't you even think about celebrating Passover. John Chrysostom, he was called the Golden Mouth. He was a pastor in Syria, Antioch. A pastor. I don't know what he was. Christians are to hate them and long for their blood. He's talking about Jews. The Jews are the most worthless of men. The Jews are odious assassins, and for killing God, there is no expiation possible, no indulgence or pardon. Christians may never cease vengeance, and the Jews must live in servitude forever. God always hated the Jews. It is incumbent upon all Christians to hate the Jews. Golden Mouth, John Chrysostom. 415 in Alexandria, every Jew expelled, synagogues torn down, Jewish homes and businesses burned to the ground. Jerome, who translated the Bible into Latin, created the Vulgate. Jerome, a real scholar who had spent a lot of time with Jews. If you call it a brothel, speaking of the synagogue, if you call it a brothel, a den of vice, the devil's refuge, Satan's fortress, a place to deprave the soul, an abyss of every conceivable disaster, or whatever you will, you are still saying less than it deserves. That's where you're sitting today, in the synagogue. 528, the councils of Orleans, Jews prevented from appearing in public during Easter. The Church Council of Toledo, deprived of property, made slaves, you can see it. In 1096, the Holocaust didn't really start with Hitler, I don't know if you know that, but in 1096, something called the Crusades took place. And it was a holy war to restore Jerusalem to Christians, right? And they marched in with swords and shields with a cross on the shields. Onward, Christian soldier. And this is what happened in 1099. They forced all the Jews of the city into a central synagogue and set it on fire. Those who tried to escape were forced back into the burning building. Did you know that about the Crusades? That's why Jews don't like Crusades. Billy Graham's Crusades didn't attract a lot of Jews. But pause. That's a lot, I know. And I'm saying that, I'm being sensitive when I say that, because I understand what it does. But much of Christianity's misunderstanding of Jesus is based, do you know where a foundational misunderstanding of Jesus' Judaism comes from? Paul. Why? Because, as I told you before, Paul was writing in this sort of confused world of trying to make Christians into Jews and saying, you don't have to do that, they're going to learn in the synagogue. All that Acts Council stuff that we said, right? But Paul goes on, and it's so very important. His story is very similar to Yeshua's. I mean, he was a first century Jew, a rabbi, a Pharisee. I'll prove that to you in just a second. You didn't know Paul was a Pharisee. But listen, there's no confusing what the rabbi Paul says in Romans regarding the Jews and their place in history. Past, present, future. Take all of those things that I just said about the councils and the fathers and all that, put that in one folder, and now let's move over to Romans 11 and see what Paul says. Paul. Has God rejected his people? Has he? Far from it. I am an Israelite. I am a descendant of Abraham. Go on. He then continues in Romans, and he's speaking to the Romans. And he says, next, Darren, he goes on. Okay. He goes on and he says this. So I ask, did they stumble in order that they might fall? By no means. Rather, through their trespass, the Jews' salvation has come to the Gentiles so as to make Israel jealous. Now, if their trespass means riches for the world and their failure means riches for the Gentiles, how much more will their full inclusion mean? That's what Paul's saying. And then he just slams it home with this. Pull those things I just gave you out of the folder. Remember what we just read and said and contrast them with what Paul is getting ready to tell you. But if some of the branches were broken off and you, although a wild branch, were grafted back in, you understand the metaphor? Israel, broken off, wild branch. He's using a nice gardening analogy. You were grafted in among others and now you share in the nourishing root of the olive tree. What is the olive tree? It's Israel. Don't be arrogant toward the branches. If you are, remember, it's not you who support the root, but the root that supports you. And you will say, branches were broken off so that I might be grafted in. That is true, Paul says. They were broken off because of their unbelief, but you stand fast through faith. So do not become proud, but fear. Summarizing, because if he broke them off, his chosen, beloved people for you, he could do it to you. That should be terrifying to write and say some of the things that were said. But it wasn't. And as a matter of fact, it went on. But you know, we hear Paul, he was the first Christian, he hated Jews, he did all this bad stuff, But look what he says about himself when he's in the last chapters of Acts and he's on trial. He goes and he says, well, the slide's not going to say it for us. I'm going to say it for you. Now, when Paul perceived that one part was Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, listen, brothers, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. That's the present tense. Paul! A Pharisee? What? He was a Jew, and he lived by the Torah, just like Jesus. And we get that, you know, we get that. That's the flow of Acts 15 to 11, to Romans 11, the Jerusalem Council, and Paul. Welcome, welcome, nations, according to the prophetic promises of God. We are one in Messiah. Come in, learn in the synagogue. We love you. Let's get together. But don't get cocky. Don't treat us bad. And so it continued. That was the first millennium I showed you. Here's the second millennium, and it'll be much quicker, I promise you. We're coming to the end. In the 1200s, multiple edicts requiring distinguishing clothing or badges were administered. 1434 in Augsburg saw the yellow button overcoat with a yellow patch. Jews had to wear tall yellow pointed hats in their cities. You thought Hitler invented that. No, he got it before. The Jewish ghetto. You know the term ghetto? You know where it came from? Venice. The governor of the republic created the one area in the city the Jews could live. Ghetto is an Italian word. And that's where they were put. We had a ghetto later in Warsaw and all over Germany. And then Martin Luther. And Martin Luther is a pillar of the faith. Martin Luther did and wrote and changed things so powerfully and so importantly in so many ways. And you can read his bio and you can understand those things. But I have to show you the darker side because it really matters. It really matters. Martin Luther in 1543 wrote a publication called The Jews and Their Lies. A base whoring people, that is, no people of God, and their boast of lineage, circumcision, and the law must be accounted as filth. They are venomous, bitter, vindictive, tricky serpents, assassins, children of the devil. Next to the devil, a Christian has no more bitter and galling foe than a Jew. Romans 11, The Jews and Their Lies. The final solution, you know that, right? That was Hitler's master plan. And you know sort of how it went, right? Put them in camps and burn things and kill things and do all that. Well, guess what? Hitler didn't really have that idea. You know where the idea came from? Martin Luther in The Jews and Their Lies. And these were his suggestions. Set synagogues on fire, Jewish homes broken down and destroyed, deportation to camps, confiscated property. They should be deprived of prayer books and Talmuds. The rabbis should be prevented from teaching. Passport and traveling privileges should be absolutely forbidden to the Jews. Does that sound like Nazi Germany? That's how it started, actually. And Hitler, who of course we have to, he's got to be our climax, right? He's not church, but he did say this. I believe today, this is his autobiography in Mein Kampf, page 46 in my publication, I believe today that my conduct is in accordance with the will of the Almighty Creator. That's what Adolf Hitler said. But as for the Jews, I'm just carrying on with the same policy which the Catholic Church has adopted for 1,500 years when it has regarded the Jews as dangerous and pushed them into ghettos because it knew what the Jews were like. I don't put race above religion, but I do see the danger and the representatives of this race for church and state. Perhaps, Adolf Hitler said, I am doing Christianity a great service. Conclusion. As horrible as all that sounds, hey, guests, we'd love to have you come and spend Shabbat with us. Learn about the Jewish Jesus. That was a dirty trick, wasn't it? Those quotes sort of scratch the surface, and I realize no sane or decent person would ascribe to those viewpoints or openly today admit, of course, feeling this way about Jews or Judaism. But here's the problem. Here's the problem. Those things are embedded in a hidden kind of way into the theology of how things developed. You don't have to hate Jews to be sort of a victim of the great omission. How can one teach what Jesus taught when his original teaching has been colored over and canceled from its context? The world in which he lived and thought, burning down synagogues and killing people and saying God forgot about you. Man, the 2,000-year journey away from the Jewish Jesus, is it any wonder, given those perspectives toward Jews, that Christianity would be prone to deny all things Jewish from your faith? Like the beauty of a Seventh-day Shabbat or a Passover Seder or all kinds of amazingly cool things that Jesus and all of his buddies did. But for 2,000 some years, you've been told, do not do that. You can't do that. Again, go on the Facebook page and look at some of the contents. Jesus was not a Jew. Just some BS about killing Palestinians. I mean, those are all kinds of things there. It was amazing. Jesus was, forget it. Facebook makes me mad. Ooh, I just said Facebook. When we read the New Testament, we see words about Jesus like this. Where was he found on Shabbat? Right here. Not in Macon, but in the synagogue. According to his custom, he was found there. He was celebrating Passover. He was in the temple. All very Jewish things. How could that be? Jesus hates Jews. No. Doesn't the New Testament condemn the Jews and discuss how horrible they are? Doesn't Paul condemn Jewish acts like worship and the festivals? Most of all, I mean, sons of Satan, Jesus called them. Didn't he come to do away with all that? And the answer is no. The answer remains no. It was no. It is no. But without a foundation, you might think it's yes. And it's no. So we're repairing the canvas, or repainting the canvas. I learned this from my mom and my wife, who are artists. If you mess up on a canvas, you don't have to throw the canvas out. You can whitewash it, right? You can just cover it up, repaint it. And so we go back one. Go back one if I have. There he is. Blonde-haired, blue-eyed Jesus. And without intending any disrespect at all, we're going to whitewash that canvas and we're going to move on to that Yeshua on the next slide. Who, when he was called up in the temple in Luke to come and read, he picked up the scroll and read Isaiah. Because he was in the synagogue reading, not from that. I mean, this is the ark. This is where we keep the Torah scrolls. And I realize that's a painting. But these are the words of God. They informed the foundation of not only your Jewish faith, if you're Jewish, but your Christian faith, if you're a Gentile. So we're whitewashing that canvas. And over the next 3 weeks, we're going to cover with some new brushes. Some new colors, maybe a new style. We're going to make a beautiful piece of art that you can take with you, even if you never come back here. Implanted in you will be a new bit of truth about the Messiah Jesus. And that's worthwhile. Shabbat Shalom.
We're building the kingdom and thankful that you're a part of that mission. If this teaching inspired you, please consider a financial gift to support the work of Shalom Macon. Visit MaconMessianic.com and click Give Online. May the Lord bless and keep you.